Good morning. There is a handout in the back for today's lesson if you didn't pick one up. And also in the back, there's a handout from the lesson from last week, and I'd like to thank my co-teacher for handling that lesson. The handout from last week is very important through the whole course of study, so I encourage you to hang on to that one for sure. It has a very important timeline that we'll refer to probably in almost every lesson, and I've put some extra copies of that out in the back. Also, if you'd like any of the handouts or class notes or audio copies of any of the lessons, they're all available on the website, thywordistruth.com. Thywordistruth.com, also given at the bottom of the handout. And at that website, you will find detailed class notes, audio copies of the lessons, all the handouts, a lot of other material there that we talk about during the class. With regard to the history, if you found that particularly interesting, like I think the history of this time is very interesting, the definitive book on this period of history is called Persia and the Bible by Edwin Yamuchi. And I will put a link to this at Amazon on the webpage if you'd like to look into that. But it's a kind of the definitive treatment of Persia and its relationship to the Bible. The first six chapters of Ezra describe the first return from exile. And if you look at your handout from the first lesson, you'll see the first return is listed up here under Sheshbazzar in 538. And that's the return that's being described in the first six chapters of Ezra. In fact, the greater part of this book of Ezra tells the story of these early pioneers, this story that happened a whole lifetime before that of the author, Ezra. Ezra does not make an appearance until chapter 7. And that's about 80 years after the events we're looking at here in chapter 1. And about 60 years after the completion of the temple that we'll see also in the first six chapters of Ezra. So the book of Ezra is really broken into two parts, the first six chapters and then the final chapters. And in between those two parts, we have the book of Esther, the events in the book of Esther. And my plans at the moment are for us to treat these two books chronologically, which means we're going to look at the first six chapters of Ezra, and then we're going to look at Esther, and then we're going to come back and finish out the book of Ezra so that we look at it in a chronological manner. We really can't overstate the importance of this return of God's people from exile. Both Jeremiah and Ezekiel had explained the reason behind the exile. Why were they being punished? Jeremiah and Ezekiel had explained that in great depth. They should not have had any question about why they were dragged off into exile. But Jeremiah and Ezekiel had also contained messages of hope that there would be a return, that this would not be a permanent exile, but they would come back. And in fact, that's what we're seeing here. And those prophecies of hope in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, that's what kept them going. And now they're experiencing that great return that had been promised. Now, many of the Jews in Babylon were very comfortable there, and they didn't want to return to Judah. But many others prayed for and desired for this wonderful return back to their home, their land, so that they could worship God in their temple and the way God wanted to be worshiped. And they longed for that and desired for that, and that's what we're reading about here in the first six chapters of Ezra. We are going to study about those that stayed behind, but that'll have to wait till we get to Esther. This book of Ezra tells us about an exodus, a second exodus. Not the exodus we read about in Exodus, but the exodus we read about in Ezra. An exodus out of Babylon and back to the land of promise. It is one of the most important events in God's plan of redemption. And we're going to be studying that here in the book of Ezra. Let's start in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Now, at this point, many commentaries begin to tell us about Ezra's, quote, theological interpretation of events, close quote. That is, they tell us how Ezra and the Jews interpreted these events around them in terms of their theology. And the underlying thought behind comments like that is that, you know, while Ezra may have viewed the events that way, the events really had another explanation. For example, while verse 1 says that God caused Cyrus to make this proclamation, these commentaries will tell us, well, that's just how Ezra saw it. But in reality, Cyrus was just acting on his own. And this was just interpreted through the eyes of Ezra's theology. Well, of course, we have to reject that view. If God's word tells us that God caused Cyrus to issue the proclamation, then God caused Cyrus to issue the proclamation. That's how it happened. And in fact, that is what happened. And let me ask you, in fact, to those who would say otherwise, let me ask them a question. Why did Cyrus issue such a decree in the first place? In fact, as we know, he issued other such decrees for other captive peoples. Why did he do that? What caused Cyrus to take a position with regard to captives that was totally different from what anyone had done before? The Assyrians, the Babylonians, Cyrus totally changed how captives were treated. Why did he do that? Or let me rather ask, who caused him to do that? Ezra 1 verse 1 gives us the answer to that question. God caused him to do that. God stirred up his heart to do that. And is that really that hard to believe? Remember, God called him by name before he was born in the book of Isaiah. What we see here is the providence of God working on behalf of his people. And that is a central theme in the book of Ezra. As we go through chapter 1 and chapter 2, we're going to start seeing the themes in this book. And one of the central themes is the providence of God working on behalf of his people. God preserved the covenant people during the exile. God fulfilled his promise to bring them back to their homeland. And he did these things using the rulers and kingdoms of this world as tools so that he could fulfill his plan. One commentary says, behind this opening verse lies the affirmation that all the might of the ancient world was in subjection to God and put at the disposal of his people for their salvation. Verse 1 makes it very clear that what Cyrus did was not just an accident. It was not just a coincidence. God caused Cyrus to act in this way. Why? Because he was fulfilling the promises he had made to the prophet Jeremiah and through Isaiah. Jeremiah had foretold that the Babylonian captivity would last 70 years, and then God would fulfill his gracious promise to bring them back to this place, and God is doing that through Cyrus. If you circle words in your Bible, look there in verse 1 where you'll see stirred up or moved and circle that. That word is crucial. It is a crucial link in understanding verse 1's relationship to the earlier prophecies about Cyrus. It is the same Hebrew word that we find in Jeremiah 51, in Isaiah 41, and Isaiah 45. Jeremiah 51 verse 1, thus says the Lord, behold, I will stir up the spirit of a destroyer against Babylon. Same word. Jeremiah 51 verse 11. Sharpen the arrows, take up the shields. The Lord has stirred up the spirit of the king of the Medes. The same word, describing the same event. Isaiah 41 verse 2. Who stirred up one from the east, whom victory meets at every step? The same word, describing the same event. Isaiah 41 verse 25. I stirred up one from the north, and he has come from the rising of the sun. The same word, the same event. Isaiah 45, verse 13, I have stirred him up in righteousness, describing Cyrus. The same word, the same event. And if you look there in Isaiah 44, verse 28, and Isaiah 45, verse 1, you will see Cyrus mentioned by name before he was born. You will not find a more remarkable prophecy in the Bible than that. Mentioned him by name before he was born. In fact, you will not find more detailed prophecies than these. And we're seeing here their fulfillment. God called Cyrus by name before he was born and foretold exactly what he would do. Build my city, set my exiles free. And that's what he did. As we mentioned, Jeremiah foretold the Babylonian captivity would last 70 years. Well, what were the beginning and ending points of that 70-year period? Let's start with what they were not. If we start the captivity with the... And you might look at your chapter one, lesson one handout for this. If we start the captivity with the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 and end it with the first return in 538, we get only 50 years, so that can't possibly be the starting and the ending point. If instead we take the same starting point, destruction of Jerusalem, and we go all the way to when the temple was completed, well, that's much closer. That gives us 73 years. It's a possibility. If we start with Babylon's defeat of Assyria in 610 and go to the first return in 538, that gives us 73 years also. And that's also a possibility. In fact, some argue that Jeremiah 29:10 is really referring to the period of Babylonian rule, which means that might even say this is the better possibility. But the one I like the best is starting with the first captives, which included Daniel, and that was back in 605, and going all the way to the first return, which we're looking at right here in Ezra 1. That's 538, and that gives us 68 years. And I think that option is the most likely. Well, should we be concerned that we don't have an option there that gives us exactly 70 years? We got to 68 and we got to 73, and the one I favor has 68. No, we shouldn't be concerned by that. First, they all round to 70 years, and we know already that a number of the numbers in these books are rounded figures. Second, what does it really mean if we say exactly 70 years? I mean, down to the month, down to the day, down to the second? I mean, there's no real end to that requirement if we start saying it has to be exactly 70 years. Third, God may have shortened the 70 years somewhat in His mercy, and if so, that wouldn't have been the last time. Matthew 24:22, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. So there are a number of explanations. And fourth, dating these events is not an exact science. We could easily be off by a few years on some of the dates that we've given for some of these events. So I favor the captivity of Daniel going all the way to the return we're looking at here, which is just almost exactly 70 years, and maybe exactly 70 years if some of our dates are off. Now, as a quick aside, Daniel, of course, plays a central role in this period of time. And if you look in Daniel chapter 9, you're going to see the famous prophecy of the 70 weeks. And if you want to know more about that prophecy and how it relates, if at all, to the 70 years we're looking at here, we have detailed study of Daniel on our website. And I'd encourage you to go there and look up the notes for Daniel chapter 9, which looks, in fact, at a lot of these same returns we're looking at here with regard to the 70 weeks and those prophecies. Now, the proclamation in verse 1 of Ezra 1 was given in the first year of Cyrus, which the context confirms would have been the first year of his reign over the Jews in Babylon, which most date to beginning in the spring of 538, after he conquered the city in the fall of 539. This famous edict of Cyrus that we're about to see in verses 2 through 4 appears two other times in the Bible. It's going to appear later in Ezra chapter 6. We're going to study it again when we get there. It also appears at the end of 2 Chronicles, which you'll see just a few pages before where you are now in 2 Chronicles 36, 22 through 23. The final phrase in verse 1 is very important. It says, to put it in writing. The word writing there means it was intended for the public eye. This was something that other people would come up and read. It was a proclamation that people would approach and read. And you can just picture in your mind the Jews crowded around reading that wonderful proclamation that had come up from Cyrus. It was not just announced orally. It was written down. And the fact that it was written down is going to be crucial in the later chapters of Ezra. We're going to see it again. And the fact that it was written down is going to be extremely important. It was written down. Verses 2 through 4. Let me pause here and say I'm not going to have the time to read every single verse that we study if we're going to finish our two books in our allotted time. So I encourage everyone to have their Bible open, and as I talk about the verses, please read through them as we talk about them. The decree that Cyrus issued is in verses 2 through 4 of Ezra chapter 1. And the first thing we notice about this decree, as you read through it, is the apparent piety of Cyrus. It sounds as if he's a true believer in the God of Israel as you read through this proclamation. Well, was he? I think it's very unlikely, because I think he was still a polytheist here. Although, I will say it was possible. Why do I say that? Particularly because of those prophecies in Isaiah that had included his name. Josephus tells us that Cyrus was shown those prophecies by the Jews. And you can imagine Cyrus looking at this ancient book and seeing his name in there and what it said that he would be doing. And I'm sure that impressed Cyrus quite a bit and may have had a little bit of a hand to do in the events here. Now, some historians cast doubt on the notion that Josephus tells us that Cyrus was shown this. But I'm looking at these events and thinking, can't you imagine the Jews seeing Cyrus come into power, knowing his name is in their own holy book? I think they would rush to show that to him. So I think he was shown that. So, you know, that may explain the piety we see here. Another explanation, though, is that I think Cyrus told the Jews to write the proclamation. I think that's the most likely explanation. In fact, I think we see that in some of the other decrees, that he used native scribes to write the proclamation in the way that the native people would understand it and appreciate it. So I think it's very likely that the Jews wrote the proclamation and then had kind of put those words into Cyrus's mouth. You know, we sometimes forget that the Jews were the only monotheist at this time. I mean, that was unique in Jewish history. If you want to look for a proof of the inspiration of the Bible and the truth of the Bible, look at that. What caused the Jews to understand monotheism? Well, it was the revelation by God, the one and only God, that caused them to understand that. All the surrounding peoples just thought there were all sorts of gods. They were polytheists. So I don't think Cyrus would have had any problem at all fitting God into his polytheism. The more, the merrier. And in fact, if you look at the English translation on handout for lesson 2 and read it, you'll see Cyrus talking about other gods and saying, hey, you know, put in a good word for me. So I don't think Cyrus would have had any problem working in another god into his polytheism. By the way, that Cyrus cylinder there on the second handout, the one for today, is extremely interesting and extremely important with regard to our study. Like most things, many things in the Old Testament, the quote-unquote modern scholars used to scoff at a lot of this and saying, oh, that really didn't happen. Cyrus never issued such a decree. And then suddenly we dig up the Cyrus cylinder, and there's a very similar decree for another people. And we understand that, yes, this was a policy of the Persians. And it's very similar to the decree we find here in Ezra chapter 1. So you can read there about the Cyrus cylinder, which is on display in the British Museum. Later, when we get to Ezra chapter 6, we're going to look at an Aramaic version of this decree. And it's often said to be the same decree we find here, but there are some differences. And I think the most likely explanation for the differences is that we have two decrees for two different purposes. The decree here in Ezra 1 is the public decree meant for all to see. I think we're going to find when we get to Ezra 6 that that decree was for a particular purpose so that the treasurer would know what to release to the people who were returning. So there were actually multiple decrees for various purposes. The phrase, let him go up in verse 3, that's permission. That's not a command. Cyrus was not ejecting the Jews from the country. In fact, we know that many stayed behind. He's giving them permission to go. And this would not have been an easy decision at all. As I mentioned, they were relatively comfortable in Babylon. And so they were leaving for a life of hardship and suffering that began with a four-month journey. The 4 months it took to get back to the Promised Land. But it was easier because they had a purpose, and we see that purpose here, to rebuild the house of the Lord. That purpose is going to be what keeps them going, to rebuild the temple. Now, some commentators look at the word survivor in verse 4 and say, well, that would have immediately brought back to their mind the word remnant that we saw throughout our study of Isaiah. And I agree, although I will say some commentaries say that that word survivor is a little ambiguous there. And they say it could be understood to be those who remained behind, in which case verse 4 would be an encouragement for those remaining behind to then give financial support to those who were returning. And perhaps if that's the case, that provides additional evidence that the Jews had a big hand in writing this proclamation, because I really don't see how Cyrus would have put that part in. I'm not sure why it would have mattered to Cyrus if the remaining Jews gave financial support to the returning Jews. So I think the Jews had a big hand in writing that proclamation. Verse 5 tells us that those who returned were those whose spirit God had stirred up to go up and rebuild the house of the Lord. Where have we seen that word before? That's the exact same word that we saw in verse 1 to describe how God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus to write the proclamation. God was accomplishing His plan of redemption using His own people, just as He was using Cyrus. He was using what He needed to do to accomplish His plan of redemption. And His plan required His people to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild that temple. And that's what they were doing. And once again here, we see the goal of that return, to rebuild the temple and restore proper worship. And we see something else here we're going to see throughout this book, and that is a parallel between the first Exodus and the second Exodus. The first Exodus is the return, of course, out of Egypt. The second Exodus is the return from Babylon that we're looking at here. A large part of the book of Exodus, in fact, chapters 25 through 40, big part of the book of Exodus is concerned with the construction of the tabernacle and the establishment of worship. And those are the very same things being restored here in the second Exodus. So we see a parallel between the two. We're going to see a lot of parallels between the two. A central message of the Bible is that men must worship God in the manner that God has prescribed. We see that throughout the Bible. From the beginning, we see that throughout the Bible. We see that in Genesis, in Exodus. We see that in Ezra. We see that in the prophets. We see that in the New Testament. When men forget that, it's time for a restoration. A restoration is needed. We saw such a restoration in our own recent history as men left the denominational world to restore proper worship. And we will see many parallels in our study between this restoration in Ezra and the restoration in our own recent history. And we'll be pointing those out as we go through. In verse 5, we see yet another theme that we're going to see throughout our study. And that is continuity. Continuity. The continuity between the post-exile group and the pre-exile group. These were not just two totally separate independent groups. There was a link. There were many links between the two groups. There was a continuity between the two groups. And a huge part of Ezra is to stress that continuity. That God was not starting a new plan with a new group of people. He was using the same plan with the same group. He was restoring them. He was returning them. They were the same group that had left. There was a continuity, a link between the two. And we're going to see that throughout our study. Another theme we see in verse 5. Again, I mentioned that we're going to see all these themes throughout the book, but we're seeing them right here in chapter 1. Another theme we see in chapter 5 is that while God's work requires decision, it requires faith, it also requires planning and preparation. Planning and preparation. It demands that we have goals that we're moving toward. The idea of a return to Jerusalem was a wonderful thing. But absent planning, absent preparation, absent goals, it would have accomplished nothing. Here, the immediate realizable goal was the construction of the temple. And that was the goal that they set for themselves. Yes, there would be other goals. That was the first goal. And there's a lesson there for us. God's people should never just be out there winging it. We must be a prepared people. We must be a goal-oriented people. We have a mission to accomplish. And that mission will not be accomplished absent our planning and our preparation to accomplish it. Failing to plan is planning to fail. As our society becomes increasingly casual, I fear that attitude has crept into the church. The people of God must never be casual when it comes to our mission. It is far too serious a thing. We are engaged in a serious business, and we must take it seriously. We must let the world know we take it seriously. If not, how can we ever expect them to take it seriously? This is serious business, and we see that theme throughout the book of Ezra. Verse 6 seems to have in mind more than just the Jewish neighbors of those who return. And if so, we see yet another parallel between the first and the second Exodus. Because remember those who left Egypt? they took with them supplies from their Egyptian neighbors. Exodus 3, 21 through 22, we remember the verse about them plundering the Egyptians. But do you remember Exodus 3 says they asked. I think God was stirring up the Egyptians to help them. And after all those plagues, I imagine it wasn't too hard to put together a fund of some sort to get them out of the country. And so that encouraged them on their way. And we see the same thing here as they are also leaving with financial assistance. God is using everyone to accomplish his plan. He's using Cyrus. He's using the Persians. He's using his own people. He's using those who are leaving. He's using those who are staying behind. He's using everyone to accomplish his plan. Verse 7. It's significant that verse 7 tells us that Cyrus brought out the vessels. When a king captured a nation, he would take that nation's idols and cult objects and carry them back to his own capital to symbolize his gods conquering of the other people's gods. And that's how he would symbolize that. And in fact, Nebuchadnezzar, as we know, had carried the temple articles away to Babylon in 587. We read about that in 2 Kings 24. That Cyrus is here returning those objects to the Jews shows how serious he was about this proclamation. How serious he was. He's returning this gold and this silver to the people so they can take it back and put it back in their temple. And in fact, the decree we'll see later in Ezra 6, that version of the decree specifically mentions that these objects were to be put back into the temple. Verses 8 through 11. Both the name Mithridath and the title the treasurer are Persian words. In fact, Mithridath refers to the sun god, Mithras. Sheshbazar was a Jew with a Babylonian name. And most think that also refers to a sun god, the Babylonian sun god Shamash. So we already see the Persian, the Babylonian influences that would really stay with the Jews from that point on. I mean, you could take them out of Babylon, but it was hard to take the Babylon out of the Jews. And in fact, you'll see that carry on at beginning with their names. Now, Sheshbazar quickly disappears from the scene. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But he's the one who led the first group of Jews back to the Promised Land in Ezra chapter 1. Verse 8 tells us how carefully these temple objects were treated. They weren't just thrown into a pile and said, well, there they are, you know, have at it. They were carefully counted out to Sheshbazar by the Persians. And that's quite unlike the treatment they'd received by the Babylonians. Remember how they were treated by the Babylonians? Daniel 5:23 says Belshazzar had the audacity to drink from the temple vessels. So very different with how the Persians are treating them. And again, I would ask you, why such a change with the Persians? What would have caused that? We know what caused it. God caused it. Now, some early commentaries, particularly the early ones, argue that Sheshbazar, the leader here, is really the same person as Zerubbabel, who we're going to see as the leader in chapter 2. They argue that Sheshbazar was the Chaldean name for Zerubbabel. And I suppose that's a possibility, but I lean toward the view that we have two different people here. Sheshbazar in chapter 1, and then Zerubbabel takes over in chapter 2. Well, what happened to Sheshbazar? We don't know. I think it's just very likely he died soon after the return. But we don't know for sure. We do know that Zerubbabel takes over in chapter 2. Commentaries differ on the meaning and the uses of the various items in verses 9 and 10. The gold dishes were likely the vessels that held the blood of the slaughtered animals. The word translated censers in the English Standard is uncertain, but it may have had to do with the knife that they used to slaughter, the ritual slaughter of the animals. Now, the mathematicians among us, and I know there are many, may have noticed that the numbers of items in verses 9 and 10 don't add up to the total in verse 11. Why is that? Well, it's likely that the numbers in verses 9 and 10, that was just a list of the most important items. But then when you look at all the items, you get the number in verse 11. That's what most commentaries think there on that. Yet again in these verses, we see what? The theme of continuity. We're going to see that throughout this book, and we see it right here. Those who returned were connected with those who had been taken. They were connected by families. They were connected by the items that had been carried away and that they're now taking back with them. There's a connection there. Now, we might pause here and ask the same question that the great theologian Indiana Jones once asked. What happened to the Ark of the Covenant? Well, most believe it was likely destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Ethiopians, though, will tell you that the Queen of Sheba's son went and stole the ark from Solomon, and that they, in fact, claim that the ark rests today in their cathedral at Aksum. They're not giving tours, but that's what they claim. My opinion is that neither of those things happened. It's just my opinion. My opinion is that God took the ark before it could be destroyed. That's what I think happened. I have no basis for that other than my reading of the Old Testament and how God felt about the Ark of the Covenant. That's my view. Some people point to Revelation 11:19 for support of that. There it says, "Then God's temple in heaven was open, and the Ark of His Covenant was seen within His temple." Although, many of you I know were in my six-month class on Revelation right here. You'll remember that verse, of course, is figurative. So I don't think I'd point to that verse for support, but that is still my opinion. If that was not the case, then Nebuchadnezzar almost certainly destroyed it in his destruction of the city, because we don't see it again. The short phrase at the end of verse 11, "when the exiles were brought up from Babylonia to Jerusalem." Again, if you highlight things in your Bible, that's one to highlight. It's one of the most important events in history. Not just in the history of God's people, not just in the history of in history. That is one of the most important events in history. It would not have been seen that way at the time. Not at all. In fact, perhaps not even by those who were returning. But men are poor judges of the momentous. Men are poor judges of the momentous. We tend to amplify that which is trivial and denigrate that which is important. And we see that there's no better example of that than this we're looking at here. We must always strive to see things as God sees them. And when we do, we will see that the great news events of our day are not that great at all. What we will see is that the truly momentous events in history are happening right here among God's people as we work in His kingdom on this earth. That is how God sees it, and we need to see it the same way. Ezra chapter 2. One of the books in my library is entitled "How to Enjoy the Boring Parts of the Bible." Now, it might seem sacrilegious to some to suggest that parts of the Bible are boring, and perhaps it is, but I think most would likely agree that Ezra 2 is not one of the most exciting chapters of the Bible. But as one commentator noted, as uninviting as this chapter may seem, it is a monument to God's care and to Israel's vitality. If this chapter or any other chapter ever seems boring to us, then it's our fault. We just haven't studied it enough. We need to look more deeply into God's Word, and when we do, we will find that every single verse, every verse, contains great and marvelous lessons for us. And that includes every single verse in Ezra chapter 2. Well, why was this chapter with its lengthy list of names included? What value did it have for its initial readers? What value does it have for us? We've already seen that continuity is a major theme in the book of Ezra. And continuity is a major reason for the presence of this list. Ezra and his readers were very concerned about the continuity between themselves and those who had gone before the exile. And this list shows that link. That continuity between the two groups. They needed to know that God's covenants and God's promises applied to them as they had applied to the people before the exile. And this list gives the linkage between the two. It's also important to preserve the purity of the people. Another theme we're going to see in Ezra. And we see here these people pointing back to their ancestry among those who had gone before. Again, stressing the purity of the people. Another possible reason for the list is to legitimize the land rights. These people were going back to claim land. Yes, the Jews had left their homeland. Yes, others had moved in after they had gone. Yes, the Jews were returning and wanted their land back. Yes, history has a way of repeating itself, doesn't it? But there's a crucial difference between the return of the Jews under Ezra and the return of the Jews under Harry Truman. The former was a part of God's plan to bring Jesus Christ into this world, and the latter was not. Jesus had already come into this world. The return we're seeing here is a very different return from the other returns that we've seen throughout history, in fact, even in our own recent history. This return was the promise of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and this return is what kept that link alive in God's plan of redemption moving forward. Some of the names are listed by ancestral families, and some are listed by geographical locations. Why the difference there? Well, some suggest that the latter were the poorer people who didn't have land in their name, and others suggest that the former were those that could trace their lineage back to some particular person, while the latter were just those who could trace their name back to some town they remember they used to live in. And that may be supported by the observation that these geographical locations are the ones they came from before the exile rather than the ones they were going to. It's interesting, there's no reference in this chapter to towns in the Negev south of Judah. Why is that? Well, those were the ones where the Edomites moved in. And so they weren't going back there. In fact, you might read about Obadiah. Read Obadiah to read more about the Edomites. One more reason why I think we have all these names here. I think we can see it not in Ezra 2, but in Mark 14. In Mark 14, verse 9, Jesus is speaking about the woman with the alabaster flask. And what does he say? Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. Mark didn't give us her name, but she's being honored here today, isn't she? Right now, as we remember her act of loving kindness toward Jesus. Ezra 2 is filled with such people. Why did they leave their homes to return to a place of suffering and hardship? Because they loved God. Because they longed to worship God as God wanted to be worshiped. And for that, God is honoring them here in Ezra chapter 2. And when you read their names and their descriptions, think about their example. I like what one commentary said on this. To God, each individual and family is significant. Thus, the group of the returnees is not simply lumped together, but valuable space in Scripture is given to otherwise unknown families and individuals. The group of exiles was not large, but it was vital to God's plan. They are the heroes of this drama. Through them, God's purposes in Israel were continued. It's through this group and their descendants that we have the Scriptures that they preserved. It's through this group and their descendants that Jesus came into this world. Even though they were practically unnoticed in the world at this time, they were the center of God's plan of redemption. The church today often suffers from a minority complex. We sometimes feel as if we're of little significance in this modern world that seems to be rushing past. But we need to see ourselves as God sees us. We are the center of His attention. We are the center of God's attention. We are the means by which He is fulfilling His plan today, just as these people in Ezra 1 were the means by which He was fulfilling His plan in Ezra chapter 1. Are we a minority? Yes, we are in a minority. But we need to remember that God's people have been in a majority only two times in the history of the world, just after creation and just after the flood. Other than that, we have always been in the minority. Verses 1 and 2. The word province in verse 1 probably refers to Judah rather than Babylon. And it's likely this list includes different groups that returned to Babylon at different times. This would help explain why Zerubbabel is listed here, while Sheshbazzar was the leader in chapter 1. Again, we don't know what happened to Sheshbazzar when Zerubbabel took over, but at some point that happened. And Haggai 1 verse 1... Haggai, by the way, is a prophet. He's on your lesson one handout, prophesying a little later than the time we're looking at here, about 20 years later, I think. But he says that Zerubbabel was the leader in Haggai 1, verse 1. They each returned to his own town. Again, that emphasizes the continuity here. They're returning. They're claiming their territorial inheritance. They're reaffirming their roots in the land that they had left, their rights to this land. They're reaffirming that. They had rights to this land, and God was giving it back to them. Several of the leaders' names in verse 2 are familiar. Jeshua, we're going to see him a lot. He was the high priest and is referred to as Joshua in Haggai and in Zechariah. According to Haggai 1, verse 1, he was the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, which would make him the grandson of Seraiah, the high priest before the exile. So right there we have a link. That's a link to the high priest before the exile. Jeshua, the high priest, and Zerubbabel, the grandson of a king, play a major role in the prophecies of Zechariah. So close was their partnership, Jeshua and Zerubbabel, so close was their partnership that Zechariah used it as a foretaste of the perfect regime that was to come, when priesthood and royalty would be perfectly combined in Jesus Christ, perfectly united by the man whose name is the branch, as Zechariah refers to him. And as the book of Hebrews tells us, that uniting of priest and king could not happen under the old covenant. Because under the old covenant, the king was from the tribe of Judah. The priest was from the tribe of Levi. That could not be in a single person. And yet Zechariah tells us that someday that would be in a single person. For those out there today who say that the old covenant has not passed away, that the old covenant was never intended to pass away, ask them to read Zechariah. Either the old covenant passed away or the prophecies of Zechariah failed. Those are your only options, the only options. The truth, of course, is that the old covenant did pass away. It was replaced by the new covenant. And under the new covenant, king and priest are combined in Jesus Christ. And Zechariah uses Zerubbabel, the leader here, and Jeshua, the high priest here, as a foretaste of that perfect combination of king and priest. Now, the Nehemiah listed in verse 2 is not the Nehemiah, the famous Nehemiah of 445 B.C. And Mordecai listed here is almost certainly not the Mordecai from the book of Esther. What we're seeing here is something we'll see elsewhere in this book, and that is we have some very similar names, very common names, rather, that apply to a number of different people. The timing is just off for that. As we know, Nehemiah and Ezra showed up 80 years after this time. And some of the other names are very similar, and I mentioned those in the class notes, which you can find on the web page. There is a similar list of names in Nehemiah chapter 7, but there's a difference. That list includes one extra name, Nehemani. Now, some suggest that that name used to be in Ezra 1, but through the process of copying, it got dropped. And I tend to favor that explanation. Why? Because if you take that one extra name and add it to the number of names we have here, you have 12 names. And once again, we see a link. 12 leaders, 12 names, 12 patriarchs. You see the link to what came before. And Nehemiah 7, the same list, has that one additional name. Verses 3 through 20 are the names of the clans or the families that returned. The end of verse 2 describes them as the men of the people of Israel. Now, the Bible usually reserves Israel for the entire nation or for the northern tribes. Here, it really uses it to refer to the two southern tribes that are returning. Why? Because it's also a link to the Israel of old, to the covenants, and that link back. That's why it uses Israel here. Now, the names in this list are nearly identical to those in Nehemiah 7. What's different are the numbers. The numbers are quite a bit different. And one commentator suggests that may have been due to what he described as the notorious difficulty in copying Hebrew numbers. They were very difficult to copy, and errors could creep in through the process of copying. Vertical strokes were used for units. Horizontal strokes were used for tens. And then they used the first letter of the Hebrew word mia for hundreds. And so you get all these little vertical strokes and horizontal strokes and things, and it's easy for a stroke to be overlooked or miscopied. And I think that explains some of the differences in numbers we've seen between Ezra and Nehemiah. And again, some of these clan names occur elsewhere throughout. Pahath Moab in verse 6 is interesting. That literally means the governor of Moab, and he may have been a governor in Moab prior to the exile. We read about such a person in 1 Chronicles 4:22. When we come back next week, we're going to pick up with verses 21 through 35, which describes people by their geography. And again, I encourage you all to read these chapters before we come each class, because I don't have the time to read each verse here in class. And again, these notes, the audio, the handouts will all be posted on the website, thywordistruth.com, and available throughout this week and then in future times. So thank you very much for your attention. And next week we'll continue on with verse 21 of Ezra chapter 2.